This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York. For more, visit theannexpodcast.com.
I want to talk about the engagement of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
Big news in my family. No, it is. My mother's side is they're royal watchers. I'm Canadian, so it's like a thing.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, I'm like, my family's from the Anglophonic Caribbean. You know what I mean? And even through independence, I mean, we're still, you know, the British influence is still, I mean, it's still deep. And for me, the reason why this is so significant, I'm not a royal watcher, and I don't care about celebrities, but finally, we get a real, for real, black princess. There is now a black princess in the British crown, people.
Oh, so is this like some kind of dig on the Disney movie with Princess and the Frog? That doesn't count. That's your objection.
Well, I mean, she's going to be a bona fide princess. She's marrying into the royal family, right?
And that does sound, you know what that I does mean? Sound decidedly and it's like, more official than.
Yeah, and like, you know what I mean? It's like my little daughter isn't going to be playing with her Tiana doll and have another kid playing with her Cinderella doll and have the other kid turn around and say, "Well, she's not a real princess." Because you know what? Meghan Markle is about to be a real princess.
I didn't even know that she was a woman of color. I'm not an avid royal watcher, but that's wonderful. Well, she's American, right?
Yeah, she's American. She's an actress. You know, full disclosure, she's what some might call biracial. One of her parents is black. The other parent is white. And so, you know, people might fight about it like they did or like they do whenever there's good stuff to be had, you know, all of a sudden, like America's hypo descent rule as it applies to black folk, all of a sudden doesn't apply anymore. You're like, oh, but she's half white, right? Just like they did during Obama's bid for the presidency. And then when it's time, and when bad stuff comes around, then all of a sudden hypo descent comes back, right? They're like, move to the back of the bus. You can't ride in the Pullman car. And if you were president between the years of 2009 and 2016, then you were black.
It will be wonderful, though. I didn't know about that. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful.
Also a Northwestern grad I saw.
Mm.
I have a...
And American. You think that's going to fuel anything, some royal fever here in America? Americans?
Americans were gaga for Princess Di. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what? I don't know. I think it depends, you know, on whether or not we really are having a racial moment, right? Is her Americanness going to trump the fact that she's basically black, right? Or is this going to be one of the things that unite us all, right, across the color line?
Is there some type of research that that shows that like black celebrities are not seen as black when they reach a certain level of public esteem? I'm thinking of, there's a famous movie, I forget which one it is, where it's like, it must have been from the 90s, where it's like Michael Jordan doesn't count as black.
Oh, talking about Do the Right Thing.
That's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Has that ever been borne out in evidence, like that people's blackness is taken away when they're widely liked or famous?
Well, I haven't seen any studies, but, you know, anecdotally speaking, you know, when Beyonce did the Super Bowl halftime, apparently I hear a lot of white people lost their minds, right? They were like, what? Beyonce's black? Why is she doing the black power salute? What's happening?
So whether or not there's literature on that, I thought there was literature on basically when someone's a stranger, you'll do the Bayesian inferencing and all that sort of thing and apply stereotypes to get a conception of them. But once you get to know somebody, they just have their own personal identity. Is that correct? I just kind of have a vague association. It's not like I've read a bunch of articles on that lately.
It's like, you know, you can hate all people of group X, except for the one that
you know. I hate Canadians until I got to know Joe, and you know. You're a credit to your nationality, Joe. Well, wait a second, because, you know, I mean, if you're thinking about this, I mean, I think it's just that, you know, here's two relatively high profile young people and they fell in love. And I think at this point, you don't really have dynastic policy as a meaningful concept anymore. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you are talking about it in terms of like, oh, now there's a princess who represents, you know, the new world or, you know, black people or something like that, you know, you could think of it in terms of those countries that do have serious dynastic policies, they very often do have not the thing that we saw in Europe for a long time of almost like an incestuous style royal dynastic policy, like that characterized the Habsburgs. But you'll have a deliberate policy of marrying into, you know, different peoples who are part of the empire. You know, that was a classic thing of a lot of Persian-speaking empires, for instance. So if you look at the, you know, early Mughal dynasts, they, you know, they look Central Asian or Turkic. And then, you know, by the later period, they look Indian. And that's because, you know, over successive generations, they kept marrying, you know, local princesses. Not all dynasties do that, right? So the Ptolemies didn't do that at all. They stayed as a Greek dynasty, even though they were in Egypt, but they never intermarried with the local Egyptians.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting, right? Some dynasties understood that that genetic diversity is actually good for the line.
I don't think they were because worrying about how to get rid of hemophilia.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I think it was much more about drawing connections between the royal household and different constituencies.
No, for sure. But they figured out that you could do that without marrying your first cousin.
Well, I'd say that's more of an ancillary benefit. I mean, certainly from our perspective, looking at like, you know, these people with these really horrible genetic diseases, we look at that. And especially because in our culture, we have a very strong incest taboo. You know, we see that as like, oh, well, of course, you just want to do it for the genetic benefits. But that's because we think about things in terms of, you know, and we're a culture where you get your genes screened to make sure that you aren't going to pass on genetic diseases to your kids and that sort of thing. But, traditional cultures, marriage is much more about political power and social affiliation. And so I think if you have a royal household marrying a, you know, someone from, say, a local community who's part of the subject peoples of the empire, that has nothing to do with, oh, we want to make sure that, you know, three generations from now, we're not a bunch of hemophiliacs. It has much more to do with we want to make these people not rebel because they'll feel a connection to the royal house.
Oh, no, definitely, for sure. But I mean, one of the ways to also shore up your power is to make sure that you have healthy offspring, right? You know, it's like, you know, and if you keep, you know, if they all die during infancy or if they all, you know, are born with hemophilia or whatever else, right? You're just like, dude, you know, we're going to have to ditch this one and get another wife soon.
Yeah, and that's it. One other issue, I don't know if anybody noticed this. She's older than Harry.
Well, I know.
And she's divorced, right? So that's the thing we haven't been talking about. Like, there's all this thing of like,
is she
black? Is she half black? Does it count as black hypo descent? All that sort of stuff. Is she
It's because it was my answer.
But like traditionally, that would have been the single most important thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like, if you think of like the traditional notion of like who can marry into the royal household, it's like, you know, A, is she a Protestant? B, is she never married, see all these sorts of things. But, you know, that she just kind of like converted like right before the engagement to Anglicanism. Nobody cares about that. You've seen basically nobody mention it. Mm-hmm. And that she's divorced is the kind of thing that was disqualifying in the early 20th century. You know, we saw a king.
Yes, so would have been her being black. So.
Well, but not as explicitly, right? There wasn't like a rule. There was a rule that said you had to be never married and an Anglican. There was no explicit rule. There might very well have been a tacit rule.
I bet it was a pretty strong tacit rule.
I will agree with that, but I'm saying it wasn't written down, you got to be white. It was written down that you have to be an Anglican and never married.
I would imagine, though, although it was unwritten, it would be like, it would be such a profoundly important rule that, like, it didn't even need to be written out. Yeah. Right?
Right.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. For more information, visit theannexpodcast.com. Music is by Lena Orsa. Our production team included Anika Chowdhury and Liseth Moreno. On behalf of the Annex team, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.